Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:19 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is August 6th and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I think there's a lot of things to talk about right now because we seem to have this rather odd contradiction in the markets. Because on the one hand, we have health authorities and people in the know with regard to the pandemic saying that there's a growing risk from the Delta variant and also from the Epsilon variant and the Lambda variant. So it's not like the pandemic is over. And certainly there are uncertainties out there about exactly what's going to happen. And on the other side of that argument, you have central banks where we have had the RBI this week in India saying that they're going to, or they plan to withdraw liquidity, and they even refused, refused to sell bonds in here today because they thought the yields were too high. Then we've had the Bank of England talking about the need to withdraw liquidity and taper, and the Federal Reserve. Large numbers of people on the standing committee have been, or well, on the governing council of the Federal Reserve have been talking about the need for them to taper. Although Jay Powell was very clear in stating last week that there wasn't any hurry, but nonetheless, we've continued to see central bankers talking about tapering. Then, of course, you have central bankers who are in fact tapering. So you have Australia that's tapering, despite the fact that they have an outbreak of the Delta variant and lockdowns in both Sydney and Melbourne. And you have Canada, which has already been tapering. So we're at this important juncture. So in many respects, we might consider that the environment that we've been presented with is the Goldilocks phase of the pandemic, where there is a sufficiently large risk from the pandemic, but that it's not so large as to impede the supply of liquidity. And of course, then the threat from the virus has to be reasonably credible in order to deter in governments and central banks of the world from withdrawing that liquidity. So I think that this is something that's going to play back and forth. This kind of argument between whether to open up, whether to shut down, is going to ebb and flow. And we have exactly this kind of conundrum being presented to a large number of companies right now, because the companies have pretty much set August timeline and potentially the 1st of September to reopen their buildings and have everybody back in person. And that's being challenged now by the rise of the Delta variant. And then just these difficult decisions about whether to enforce mask mandates, or then even more extreme, to enforce a vaccine mandate. But the big point, of course, is that we've had an incredible liquidity-fueled rally over the course of the last 17 months. And these liquidity-fueled rallies can go on for longer than anyone anticipates, and they can persist for as long as there is an ample fuel of liquidity to push asset prices higher. So there's been a lot of talk about this acronym FANGMAN. And I've recreated this chart of the combined market cap of Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Nvidia. And over the course of the last decade, and it really only goes back to 2012 because some of those companies hadn't listed before then, but it's gone from 1 trillion to 10 trillion. So we've had a 10 times advance in the size of these companies. And obviously that's a lot. And some now have market caps in excess of 2 trillion, like Apple, and others in excess of 1 trillion, like Google and Microsoft. and Amazon. So it's rational to start thinking about, well, how long can this persist? And isn't 10 trillion an awfully big number? Of course, there aren't that many people looking at it, but there's sufficiently large numbers that we're seeing it pop up in commentary. But what I think is perhaps more important is not the absolute figure, because the absolute figure on its own doesn't give us a lot of information. But I created this chart, and it's of the relative performance. And when we look at this chart, well, then we are presented with some interesting information, because it was these FANG stocks, or the expanded universe of FANG stocks, they performed incredibly well all the way up from the middle of 2019 until August of 2020. And then we had a relative peak. So we've had certainly a couple of pauses along the way over the course of this decade. There was a pretty lengthy pause around the 2016 period, and there was another lengthy pause around 2018 through to 19. So, arguably, this is another pause. But one thing that we can also very clearly identify here is that the pace of the advance did accelerate. It certainly picked up pace from the breakout in late 2019 and really did move higher in a very profound manner. And it pretty much advanced by nearly 50%, because it was around 14 or 0.14 back in 2019, and it peaked out around 0.21. So up 50% in the space of a year is a big move. And subsequently, we had a deep decline, and that was the biggest decline we've seen in the course of this bull market, particularly up from the low in 2013. So this is going to raise important questions, because we're talking about the largest companies in the world, and they represent a very significant proportion of the entire stock market. So this is a relative value. And so they represent currently approximately 19% of the total market cap of the entire New York Stock Exchange. And that's pretty significant. It's up from about 7% to 21%. So it's up three times in the space of the last 8 years. And the important thing about extremely large companies is that they act as a magnet for investment. And the financial market phenomenon of the last decade has been ETF investing. So ETFs generally track an index. Most indices are market cap weighted. And as a company's market cap expands, then demand for that share increases in line with demand or liquidity flowing into the market through the ETF space. So what it in fact means is that as the price rises, the influence of large cap companies on the performance of the index increases over time. And it peaks when the stock market peaks. Then as those larger companies start to roll over, well, they have the most influence close to the top, and then they have less influence the more they fall, because the weighting of the index will rebalance, and the new relative strength leaders will then acquire weighting within the index, so that by the time we get to the lows following any major decline, well, then the relative weighting of the very large companies will have decreased significantly. We can see a graphic representation of that when we look at the emerging markets ETF. So both Tencent and Alibaba were the largest holdings within the emerging markets universe until quite recently. But we've had a significant reordering within it. So now we have Tencent And we can simply look at that share, and it's pulled back in a violent manner. So that has significantly reduced its weighting within the emerging markets ETF. At the same time, if we look at Taiwan Semiconductor, well, that's an additional, this share has been pretty much going sideways rather than declining. So just by virtue of the fact that it's going sideways, it's now representing a larger weighting within the emerging markets portfolio. So I think this is an important consideration. Sorry, I typed in the wrong ticker again. That the longer a correction goes on for, then the less important the large cap companies, or at least the previous large cap companies, were to the overall performance. So the emerging markets ETF has pulled back in a pretty violent manner over the course of the last few weeks, and that's in direct response to the efforts by the Chinese administration to exert control over capital flows into various portions of the market. But in order for the emerging markets ETF to really turn over and to trend downwards, you would have to have a bigger problem arise in the wider universe, and that's not immediately apparent. So as trouble continues in the Chinese markets, and that's assuming, of course, that it does, well, then the relative exposure of the emerging markets ETF will decrease to China. So there is a sort of a built-in corrective mechanism in market cap weighted indices. So I do think that that's relevant when we think about the NASDAQ, because obviously the NASDAQ has got some very significant weightings among the very large companies, and these companies continue to do well. So on the one hand, we have the fact that they are no longer accelerating higher in terms of their relative market cap compared to the wider market. And what that suggests is that relative performance and alpha will be found in other sectors. And we can think about the fact that Apple is continuing to hold this move above 140, and it hasn't really frightened anybody just yet. And Microsoft is still really quite firm, and it was at least testing its highs in here today, and we might have a short-term overbought condition, but there's no real sign of any kind of angst among investors just yet. And Google has done even better, and there have been a succession of news stories about Google and its various scientific achievements, whether that is in propagating a massive database of protein folding data, or whether it's in creating time crystals with its quantum computer. And I feel like I'm speaking Greek talking about these sorts of things. But the reality is that they don't make any money from them. They may in future, but these kinds of just basic scientific discoveries, they've previously, and funding these kinds of things have been previously the realm of the public sector and governments investing in primary research. And now we have ample evidence that companies are well capable of doing this exact same primary research, and not necessarily with a profit motivation. Of course, there is the big prize that's out there, which is autonomy. And I kind of think that we're probably going to have to come up with new math or a new way of looking at problems in order to solve for it. I think the way that's being pursued right now, I would probably, if I had to bet, give the benefit of the doubt to what Tesla is doing. And one thing that I find interesting, I had two meetings this week. One was with a service provider, and they were pitching this amalgam approach to fund management. So, and there are various different companies offering these kinds of services, and they're doing the rounds among actively managed funds. So what they're basically saying is that there is a universe of funds out there, and that by tracking the fund relative to their benchmark on any given day, they can then impute or use their algorithm to figure out what it is they were buying and selling on that day. So that's, I think, rather interesting. Then what they do is they take all of that data for the various fund managers, and they'll rank the fund managers by their ability to create alpha on a sustained basis. Then they use the same kind of algorithms that Netflix uses. And Netflix or Amazon, they'll try and figure out what you like to watch based upon your use of their system, and then they'll make recommendations about what they think you'll like. It's exactly the same kind of algorithm that TikTok uses. And now this kind of amalgam. So sometimes you'll see, for example, when they're predicting which way a hurricane is going to go, that they will have different models, and then they take a line of best fit from those models, and then that's their best guess for which way the hurricane will move. And what's now occurring in the financial community is they're doing the same thing. So they're taking what lots of different actively managed funds and the better performers are doing. They're then drawing conclusions from the performance of their fund, what do they own, and then they're making that data available to their customers. Well, it's exactly this same kind of amalgam computing that goes into a lot of the ways that they're trying to figure out how to come up with the best route to take, or and that's not just simply on Waze or on Google Maps, but also for a car. So they've got lots of different data points, and then they do the line of best fit in order to try and come up with the best one, and based upon their experience and how they can teach the computer to learn. These are the, I think, rather interesting ways that data is being used to come up with novel solutions to lots of different portions of the economy, and not simply about what's the best video to watch on Netflix. Well, now let's just get back from that tangent and come back to this question, because we do have this contradiction in the market between what the health officials are saying on one hand and what central banks are saying on the other. And I do think this is going to ebb and flow. So we've had a meaningful move in here today in the 10-year yield, and it popped on the upside in a pretty dynamic manner, and it was up nearly 8 basis points. It's now testing the upper side of this short-term range and the region of the simple moving average. And when we just zoom out and look at this over the last decade, well, the trend down has been quite profound. And now the big question is, will it follow through on the upside next week? Well, in order for it to follow through on the upside, well, we would have to think, well, why are yields going up? Well, they're going up because we had strong employment data coming out of the USA, and quite apart from the arguments about whether the federal government will need to issue quite as much debt, because they are now talking about issuing $2 trillion less, or spending $2 trillion less on their deficit next year, and therefore there will be fewer bonds to buy for the Federal Reserve, so they would naturally taper their purchases in that event. But it is also beginning to price in that yields might normalize, or that, excuse me, interest rates would normalize. So we had a meaningful move at the long end of the curve, but then we can also consider that the 2-year yield has been holding reasonably steady and did not move in a big way. So We've certainly seen that there was a pop on the upside over the last 3 days for the shorter end of the curve, but it hasn't been in a big, profound manner. So there's more going on here than simply thinking about the outlook for the potential for interest rates to rise at some point over the next few years. I think investors are perhaps now starting to think more about inflation or potentially stagflation. And I think this is going to be very much tied to the outlook for the virus. So Moderna is accelerating higher. And certainly the share continues to do rather well because the potential is certainly clear that there will be vaccine mandates, and that basically, I think we're going to get to a point where anyone who wants to go back to work in an office or work anywhere will be very clearly encouraged to go and get a vaccine. And if that occurs, then it's only a matter of time before the airlines also mandate that people have a vaccine. And of course, then there will be vaccine boosters. And there's the potential that the first boosters will be available in September. So we're increasingly moving ahead. And when we think about what the logic is behind vaccines, behind boosters, behind vaccine mandates, we could have an entirely different discussion about the legality of it, or what it means in terms of individual freedoms. But that is largely irrelevant to how that is going to be interpreted by the markets. The markets will interpret it as good news because it removes the potential for additional lockdowns and it increases the potential that we can get back to normal. And by normal, what I mean is that there won't be any restrictions on economic activity. And that's really the foundation for releasing a lot of the pent-up demand. So, it's a good news story for vaccine developers, and Pfizer is up to the upper, well, back up to test the upper side of a range now that's been forming for an awfully long time. So we need to go all the way back to 2000, or really, I guess 1999, and the share rocketed higher in the 1990s with the release of Viagra. So the share is now back in the region of those peaks. And there's the potential that the coronavirus is going to be endemic, and that there will be a whack-a-mole situation, that there'll be variants popping up every now and again, and that they'll be of varying threats overall. But I think anyone who's ever played Plague Inc. or just simply think about how a virus propagates, well, they become progressively more infectious, so it's easier to get them. But then it inhibits their ability to spread if they kill people off too quickly. So then, historically at least, they do tend to get less deadly. So it's interesting to see how this one is going to progress, but there's a reasonable expectation that it should become less deadly over time, but potentially more infectious. And of course, the more people that it's active in, the greater the potential there is for mutation. And that's the biggest argument for getting as many vaccines into as many people as possible. It's to try and calm down the pace of mutation. So it's quite likely that we're going to have additional booster shots. There's going to be mandates to get as many people vaccinated as possible. And that should be, or that should continue to be beneficial. Now, in order to get that done, it means that the FDA is going to have to permit or to say that these vaccines are safe. And that will lend efficacy to the technology. So mRNA has been in development now for quite a long time, and it found its it was used first in these immuno-oncology companies because people with cancer are going to die anyway. So they become guinea pigs for every manner of emerging technology. And these companies had a really profound move in 2015, and they were revitalized in 2017. The challenge for them, though, is that you can't provide a universal or you can't provide a one-shot solution for cancer because every cancer is different, and it meant that they would have to make customized solutions, and you just can't make money doing that. So a lot of these companies have flared out and are now trending downwards. And there's really quite a lot of commonality in this sector where we had very big moves on the upside and subsequently they have disappeared. Well, they've been among the propagators of these immuno-oncology solutions and using mRNA. And it was the data from them that was used to say that these are actually safe. So we're in an interesting situation because people are still frightened. And I'm rather reminded of the quip that markets climb a wall of worry. Now, one thing that I think is particularly important is that the 200-day the 200-day moving average is a reasonable benchmark for how trends are evolving. And the number of shares trading above it or below it tends to be indicative of supply and demand. And we have lots of back history for this kind of relationship. So we can definitely think that after big declines, we get equally big rebounds. And that was certainly true in 2009, and it was true again in 2020. And every time the number of shares trading below the trend or below the 200-day moving average falls down towards about 10%, you get a rebound. And you get a rebound because it scares central banks and they start to really act as if there's a problem and they cut interest rates and they make liquidity available. So that's exactly what we saw in 2020, and it was done on a record scale. And now the number of shares trading above it, their 200-day moving averages is trending downwards. And it would be normal at this stage to see a wobble because we're in the stage today where there's a winnowing effect, where everything rallied in the run-up from the lows in 2009, and then everyone started to look at, well, what were the kinds of companies that would do really well? And which were those that would go into these lengthy periods of convalescence? If we go back and think about Amazon in 2010, well, it broke out in 2009. It was at a new all-time high. By the time we got to 2010, it was already well above the breakout point and testing the $200 area. So this was a clear upside leader. When we then think about what it meant for those kinds of companies that were at the epicenter of risk, well, arguably, Citigroup is still within its base formation. So that has been an extraordinarily lengthy process of convalescence. Well, I now look at these kinds of companies that did really very well off the lows in 2020 and recouped the entire decline. Now, Cisco is at it's a dividend aristocrat, and the share went from 85 to 25 in March of 2020. But it's the kind of company that you see in most cities because they provide the kinds of they provide sheets for hotels, they provide cutlery for restaurants, they provide basic ingredients for restaurants and hotels in the food preparation business. So they're very much attuned to what's going on in the real economy because they're a supplier of basic commodities to make every kind of service business easier to run. So they collapsed in the pandemic. And then the share started coming back because people started to put a price on dividends and quality. But the share is now trading back below its trend mean. Now, it has steadied over the course of the last couple of weeks, but it's not breaking out and it's not at a new high. And it's 100% dependent on the continued opening up of the economy. Now, I saw news this week that hotels are full and that they're back at 2019 occupancy rates. So that's good news. It means that the majority of the tourist sectors are going to have a good season, and that will help to tide them over. But the bigger question, of course, is whether the economy is going to continue to open back up. I suspect that it is. Despite I guess the threat of intermittent lockdowns, and of course there are still lockdowns in a number of countries, and Asia in particular is I think dealing as best they can with the rising number of cases. This ETF has newly been launched, and I think it is probably the first product that is now taking governance into account. So it's been going sideways for the last, well, just about all year. Whereas the MSCI Emerging ex-China ETF has been trending higher. And I think that these are the kinds of countries that will do well when we look back and think about what are the big lessons that we learned from the pandemic. The first, of course, is that the global economy is extraordinarily reliant on a large number of very cheap components, and supply of those components are really very concentrated on a very small number of countries. And then the second is that we're also extremely reliant on China for the supply of basic manufactured goods, and they're not as friendly as they used to be. So it would suggest that the ex-China portion of emerging markets is going to continue to outperform, and that countries like Vietnam, Mexico, Indonesia, India are going to outperform as well. So Vietnam continues to rebound from the region of the trend mean. The Nifty index in India continues to push on. One thing that I thought was particularly interesting in here this week was that HDFC, Housing Development Finance Corp, has rebounded pretty emphatically from the region of the trend mean and the region of the peak from early 2020. So, this is encouraging. India's housing sector and housing finance sector in particular has gone through a very profound period of underperformance, and there's been a lot of rationalization in the sector. So, it's looking increasingly likely that they're coming out of that. And that's beneficial for the wider economy as well, because what it's suggesting is that we're moving into a new credit cycle, and that should be beneficial for credit growth and for the banking sector, and that should help to fuel speculative activity and expansion in the economy. So India is likely to continue to benefit from migration away from China, from one perspective, then also Chinese migration away from China because wages are too high. So Chinese entrepreneurs are setting up factories all over Asia to access regional wage differentials and also to circumvent the tariffs. And India is also a beneficiary of that. And certainly the number of goods that I see manufactured in India continues to trend higher. We can also then think about some of these countries that have benefited from the pandemic, and Taiwan's market continues to steady here, and it's lost some momentum, but it is still trending higher. The Korean market has also benefited enormously from the pandemic overall, and again, it has lost momentum, but it is still trending higher. Singapore is one of those countries that's been dealing rather heavily with the virus of late, and the stock market continues to trend higher, but not nearly in as profound a manner as we've seen from either South Korea or Taiwan. We're in an environment where we have these uncertainties about the outlook for emerging markets because that run-up in yields in the USA has been beneficial for the dollar, and the dollar index continues to steady in the region of its trend mean. Well, I've been of the view that this is a top formation, and I was rather enthused that it looked like my view was going to be correct last week, because the index was pulling back and it has recouped most of the loss over the last 3 days. So the dollar is not out and down yet. But I think a lot of the argument about the relative strength of currencies relative to one another is very much tied to the outlook for the pandemic. And as a big developed market where there is a high number of vaccinations have already been put in place, while the USA has got relative strength at its back right now, and that's positive for the currency. It's also one of the factors that has contributed to the relative strength of the pound, despite the fact that it was in mildly negative territory in here today. One thing that's also particularly relevant is that Europe is back on the front foot, and when we start to think about the outlook for Europe overall, well, it's liquidity driven. And that's the one thing that Europe has lacked over the course of the last decade. So that's one of the big changes that's occurred. The Euro Stoxx index is now breaking out to new all-time highs. It hasn't been at these levels since early 2000, so it's the completion of a 20-year range. And it's not doing that on its own, and it's not doing it for no reason. Europe is breaking out because the ECB has clearly stated that they're not going to raise rates until they have clear evidence that inflation is taking off. So the Italian market was one of the best performers in the area today. But it's worth considering that Italy is an index that has got a lot of banks, and it also has a lot of industrials. So as we think about what the outlook is for renewed economic growth, well, I think this long-term chart of Italy is particularly relevant because it's been in this base formation for 12 years, and it's still at only a fraction of where it was back in 2000 and 2007. So there's clear potential here that the European markets are going to start attracting interest. They have the twin positive aspects, which are abundant liquidity and no real threat to the removal of that liquidity, because the ECB has been quite silent in terms of talking about its intentions to taper assistance. And when we listen to some of the members of the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or lots of other countries, they've been quite vocal in their determination that there should be tapering. Whereas in Europe, there has been less vociferous talk from these central bankers, and that's helping to support asset prices. So we can then think about the UK, because it trades on a lower valuation overall, and the FTSE 100 remains on an upward trajectory. That's a very globally oriented index, so it does tend to reflect the outlook for global growth. Then we can think about the FTSE 250, and it is extending its breakout in a manner very similar to what's happening in Europe. So it's looking increasingly likely that we're looking at a new significant bull market in European equities. And of course, there's the additional reason that they're trading on somewhat lower valuations overall and are therefore more attractive from the perspective of investors. And of course, there's the liquidity argument on top of that. Then, of course, we can, if we're thinking about value, well, Japan trades on much lower valuations overall, and large portions of the market are trading on very attractive valuations, but they're still dealing with the coronavirus. They have an extraordinarily elderly population, and they're behind the curve in terms of vaccinating the population. So that's contributing to just a pause overall. But I think we have to at least give some consideration to the fact that Japan did race ahead. The big question is, because the second section tends to be such a reliable lead indicator, if it can hold at the majority of its advance and just consolidate in the region of the peaks from back in 2018, that would be benign. If, on the other hand, it starts to break below the trend mean, well, then that will sap interest in Japan overall. And of course, if the dollar is rallying, then the nominal price of Japanese stocks should hold up reasonably well by comparison, but foreign investors will be deterred unless they're willing to hedge their exposure. To me, at least, this looks like an orderly consolidation, and we have evidence of support being found in the region of the trend mean. And what it suggests is that the Japanese are going to devalue their currency, and or at least that the dollar is going to appreciate against it. So that should improve the country's competitiveness. And one would have to think then, well, what exactly is the plan in Japan? Are they going to devalue their currency back towards that 125 area and then think that that would probably be enough? Or are they going to try and go for more in order to revitalize the domestic economy? They've tried a lot of different things over the years, and this value, or the valuations that are present in Japan, don't happen by accident. It happens because the companies are completely risk averse, and they're not willing to make expansion decisions. So that has to, at least, there is a reason why we get these kinds of valuations. But to me, at least, it does look like we're going to see the yen trending downwards. Well, we had a big move too in gold, and gold prices pulled back in a violent manner in here today, and they're back trading below the $1,800 area, and that's a direct response to the potential for yields in the USA to trend higher. But perhaps more important than that, it's more of a response to the limited liquidity argument. The primary reason that people buy gold is because they're worried about government finances. They're worried about the profligacy of governments and their determination to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. And when we listen to the US government saying that they're going to spend $2 trillion less next year than this year, well, then that improves the standing of the government. So then the price comes back down. So now the big question is, are we going to see more inflationary pressures, and will central banks be inhibited from raising rates because of the Delta variant or any one of the other variants? And if that's the case, well, then gold will find support soon, and it will hold the low around $1,700. And if that's the case, well, then we can conclude that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. Ideally, the price will bounce back on Monday, but this was a big downward dynamic, and we need to give the benefit of the doubt to the most recent dynamic. So that would suggest that all other factors being equal, there is the potential for some additional weakness. The consistency of the trend overall has been that every time it fails, it moves down by another $100 increment. So that could potentially take the price back down towards $1,600. So if it fails in this area, then there is obviously a bearish aspect to the chart right now. And that simply cannot be just ignored or rationalized away. There is definitely big downward dynamics in terms of this trend over the course of the last year, and this is questioning whether the correction is over or not. I think as we look out at the longer term, the outlook for gold remains quite positive, and it's not like governments are about to suddenly get fiscal religion again. They tried fiscal consolidation before. It didn't work. It sparked these massive populist movements, and I just don't believe that they're going to go back to that. And on top of that, there are these huge plans underway for massive infrastructure spending, and we have politicians all over the world talking about this need to accelerate decarbonization. And then we can just simply look at the natural gas price, because it's right around the $4 area, and the price hasn't been able to sustain a move above that area for at least the last 6 years. So if we're going to see more storm activity, and we have to at least remember that we're in August now, so hurricane activity is likely to pick up in the latter half of this month and into September, and that could be beneficial for prices. Then there's Göring and Rosenzweig, they are predicting that the major shale properties in the US are at peak growth. And that would raise the cost of production. It doesn't mean they're going to run dry. It doesn't mean that there's going to be that people are going to stop drilling, but it will raise the cost of production. So then that would mean that it's going to be more difficult to increase supply. It will start to lend or give power back to OPEC, and it means that we're going to have higher energy prices overall. So we're at an interesting juncture. We don't have a lot of data to support that view, and it might yet prove incorrect. And it's also a long-term effect, so it's going to have a long tail. It won't be immediately apparent. And certainly, we've had a pullback in terms of oil prices over the course of the last week, and not least because of the lockdowns that are going on in China. About half of the Chinese population is locked down now in response to the Delta variant. So again, this is another example of this contradiction that we have, where we have lockdowns in various parts of the world. We have politicians talking about the need to be much more cautious, and yet we have central bankers firing off saying that they're getting ready to taper soon. So I think it's likely at this stage that we're going to have a wobble, and we can go back and think about that number of shares trading above the 200-day moving average chart. In 2010, we got this winnowing effect where some companies were continuing to do very well, then others went through a period of convalescence, and that contributed to a significant wobble in the stock market. And I think that considering how long the market has been going up for, that it is susceptible to some weakness. And a 10% pullback on the S&P 500, which would take it back to the region of the trend mean, would probably be enough to kill off any central bank view that they're going to be able to raise rates anytime soon. I think that this is probably the most important characteristic that we have in markets right now. It's this contradiction that's going on, and the response to it from markets is still sanguine, because I don't think anybody really believes that central banks are serious. So we certainly have inflationary pressures, and these are increasingly apparent. When Mrs. Tracy was booking her freight for imports, or I guess for her order to be shipped from China to the USA this week, she was informed that it was going to cost four times more. And the Baltic Dry Index is up more than four times in the last year, and it has completed its base formation. So we're certainly seeing greater emphasis on higher costs, and those costs will be passed on to consumers. In order to encourage people back to the workforce, they're going to demand more money. We can then think about the CRB index, which has oil as a major component, and it has broken out above the 200 level. We can look at the raw industrial spot commodities index. Sorry, that didn't type that correctly. And this is now right in the region of its peaks from over the course of the last couple of decades. So we're right in the region of the peak from back in 2011. And all other factors being equal, it's likely that it's going to continue to push on the upside, but it doesn't mean that we can't have wobbles along the way. And copper has had a bit of a wobble, and it continues to wobble, but it's in the region of its all-time peak. So it's not all that surprising that we get some consolidation in the region of the all-time peaks. And as long as it's limited to a reaction back down towards $4, then I don't think anyone's going to be especially worried. The long-term bullish forecast for copper is very much dependent on the continued build-out of renewable energy assets and the continued build-out of electric vehicles and electric charging infrastructure. Eventually, we're going to have more generating capacity. One thing I think is interesting is that everything relating to renewable energy has had a pretty significant pullback, and one has to question exactly what's going on. So, uranium having broken out in a really impressive manner at the beginning of this year is now right in the region of the trend mean. And the solar sector is also right in the region of the trend mean, and it has at least given some evidence that it is firming. And the wind sector is now firming from the region of the trend mean. Well, the Brookfield is one of the more respected, I should say, private equity firms, and its Renewable Energy Partners fund is now right in the region of the trend mean. So we've seen a medium-term correction in this sector, and I don't see that there's been any real change in the impetus behind the argument for why there should be additional investment in the sector. So I think that it's much more about liquidity and it's about interest rates. And so far, I'm very hesitant to think that central banks are going to be able to do everything that they say they want to do without there being a significant reaction among investors. When we just simply think about the 10-year yield, it's been contracting for an awfully long time, and the sheer quantity of debt that's been taken out is profound. And we can then think about what it means in terms of servicing that debt, and what are the sacrifices that would need to be made in order to service that debt. So we're talking about raising taxes or cutting back spending and fiscal consolidation and doing the kinds of things that would promote economic growth. While doing all of that is going to be rather difficult, and it would suggest that there's limited scope to raise rates. There's also limited scope to afford to pay all of this or to fund the interest payments on all this debt. One of the reasons why China has had so much difficulty in with its companies this year has been because of the large quantity of debt that's maturing in emerging markets. So there's a lot of local currency short-term debt that's being refinanced this year, and that figure is almost 2 trillion. So it's certainly in the interests of the emerging markets that the dollar stayed down for longer. And it's certainly been beneficial over the first half of this year that the dollar has been reasonably weak while companies have been refinancing. If bond yields start to trend back up and we do get a break in this trend, well, then that is going to be a meaningful event. The other big development this week has been in the cryptocurrency markets. So Bitcoin has got its Lightning network up, which speeds up the number or the pace of transactions. The price firmed through $40,000 yesterday and then improved upon that performance in here today. So that's a breakout to new recovery highs. And then Ethereum has had a significant advance as well. They've successfully completed their London hard fork, and the price has been rallying now for the last 3 weeks in a row. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it has certainly confirmed a return to demand dominance. So it's gone from about $1,700 to or $1,750 to $3,000 in the space of 3 weeks, and now testing the highs from back in May and June. So it's certainly looking like a breakout and a return to demand dominance. Just how much demand dominance is going to be dependent on how much liquidity there is out there. So, in order for the cryptocurrency markets to continue to rise, well, one is then taking a bet that central banks are not going to be able to withdraw liquidity in a hurry, and that there will be abundant liquidity to fuel speculation. But there is the potential that the sector is going to get more legitimacy. There's been statements this week from the SEC, and that they do see a path towards regulation. And if that's the case, well, then regulation might reduce some of the wheeler-dealer nature of the market, but it would also introduce legitimacy and open up the market to a lot more institutional investment. At the minimum, at least, if with these upper dynamics that we've seen today, clear downward countermanding dynamics would be required to check momentum. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.